Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Women of Color Network Hour, where we discuss.
Back Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American community, in collaboration with the Women of Color Network and the African American Domestic Peace Project. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio is made possible by a grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Administration for Children and Families, Family and Youth Services Bureau, and Family Violence Prevention and Services Program. Now, points of view expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the official positions or policies of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
What number are you calling in from?
IDVAC Blog Talk Radio brings you rich conversations and education on issues surrounding domestic violence in African American and African communities.
Tracy Jackson Antoine, calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to our hour of conversation tonight. And tonight I'm going to be talking with Minister Tasha Bradshaw. We're going to be talking about a survivor's story. Before I introduce Tasha to you all, I want to say that this is a young woman who sits before me, a social worker, a student, a mother, a minister, a community leader, a daughter, a sister, and a friend. But there are many other titles that she would share, earning herself, that speak to her past. And so I'd like to introduce you all to Minister Tasha Bradshaw, and we hope that you'll enjoy the hour conversation as we talk about her survivor story. Good evening, Minister Bradshaw.
Good evening, Reverend Tracy. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited that you're here, and I'm so excited that you'll have the opportunity to share your story with listeners across the country tonight. Why don't you just start by telling us a little bit about yourself present day, and then we'll sort of work backwards to where you came from.
So as you said, I'm a social worker. I work for a small nonprofit agency supporting families who have kids with severe emotional disturbances. And in that work, I deal with a lot of moms who have history of DV, and DV is really a passion for me, that and post-traumatic stress syndrome, particularly in the African-American community, because I think at times we ignore that we've been through a traumatic experience, and we just try to move forward and march along without dealing with the pain. I have two beautiful daughters, one's 19 and one's 14. I'm a minister at a local church here in Boston, and I'm currently pursuing my master's degree in business in college. And that's pretty much it. I don't know what else you guys want to know.
No, that's really wonderful. That's very helpful. And I think it's important that we start with where you are so that as you're sharing your history as a victim survivor of domestic violence, that people will understand that you had to really take a journey to get where you are.
It definitely is a journey. A lot of times people think we just arrive, and we don't just arrive. The journey is long and it's hard, but I'm here as living proof that it's possible.
Amen, amen. You know, Bishop Jakes often says that, you know, you see the glory, but you don't know the story behind it. And I often say that some of the people who have what we would consider to be the most glorious appearance of the people who have been through the most difficult struggles. So why don't you walk us through your experience as a victim survivor of domestic violence?
So I would start my experience as waking up one morning wondering why I had let my boyfriend smack me and not really dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an only girl. I have three older brothers, and so I definitely had the protection there. I didn't utilize it. I think part of it was embarrassment. I think a lot of times women or girls get embarrassed because we know better. And then the other part of it is that I just didn't want my brothers to get in trouble because I knew what would have happened if they knew that he slapped me.
Mm-hmm.
Going on from that, he actually promised that he wouldn't do it again, which a lot of survivors say that the abuser says he's not going to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't do it again until the next time. And then it just came to be a next time and a next time and a next time. And then I let him talk me into moving in with him. And so here I am, a 20-year-old girl living with my 22-year-old boyfriend because I want to have a little bit of independence. And more importantly, I just didn't want my family to know that what I was going through. So that's pretty much where my story starts. One day I just got tired. I just got sick and tired, and I decided that I was going to fight back. And what I did is I had my best friend call the police because I wasn't able to call the police. And the police came. I asked that he leave. I made sure he gave you my keys, and that was pretty much the end of it. But during the time when we were together, it was about 3 years we were together, like he had come to my job, fought me at my job in front of my coworkers, meeting me at train stations. He knew my and he always had some I deserve to be hit. And so I started to believe some of those things, and I started to believe that I had done something wrong. And it's a long time to get out of
it. I think your story is like that of so many others. Think about the whole idea of one having had you had the protection right there, but not feeling that you could share that with your family. Because there is a degree of embarrassment and/or shame related to being a victim of any kind, and certainly a victim of domestic violence. Why do you think that is? Tell me what the shame is about for victims and survivors. Why do you think you felt that way?
Well, I think the shame comes from not wanting to, one, embarrass your family, not wanting to embarrass yourself, because 9 times out of 10, the families know. They don't like this guy. They've warned you. They've said he's no good for you. And so because you've gone against the grain of the family and decided to date him anyway, you get nervous to share that you were right. Mom, you were right. Dad, you were right. And so you kind of hide it, and it becomes a pride thing, right? And the Bible talks about pride coming before the fall. And so this is a huge fall to have to take because you're too prideful to say, you know what, Mom and Dad, you were right. He is no good. And a lot of times it's hard for young girls to go home and reconcile with their families because they've been through so much for the sake of the relationship. And so we find ourselves in a place where we don't want to say you are right, and we're here suffering. And sometimes we feel like we don't even have the help. We feel like that the parents won't take us back. And so with my daughters, what I'm careful to do is tell them that no matter what happens, I will always love you. I will always forgive you. I will always be here for you. Don't ever be afraid to come home and tell me that something happened. And I think my parents would have embraced me the same way, but I think I just didn't want to admit that they were right. And then part of it is that the abuser alienates you so far from the family. So sometimes in your mind, you're tricked in thinking that you actually don't have the support of your family when you indeed do.
Right. Talk to us a little bit about the involvement of friends. Were you in church at the time? Was there someone in church that you could confide in? Or
so at the time, I was not in church. I did share with a couple of my closest friends, but most of all, it was really a secret that I kept. It was embarrassing. It was shameful. I'm seen as a strong woman. I can be very outspoken. I can be very outgoing. And I think as I tell my story in hindsight, people are always saying, I can't believe that you would allow someone to abuse you. But the reality of it is that the abuse didn't start with physical nature. It started with an emotional abuse. And so I suffered from low self-esteem for years. And so once he realized that I had low self-esteem, he jumped on that and he hopped on that. He just beat me down emotionally and mentally. And so hitting me was just so easy because I didn't know my value. And this was before Christ. And I left him before Christ. But once I left him and I started to move on, I allowed Christ to heal me.
Yes.
and I allowed Christ to just do what he needed to do to deliver and set me free. And it's definitely a process. And even now, I'm still learning, I'm still healing, and I'm still growing. And God is still doing the work in me, because there's something deep down in the core of a woman that allows a man to abuse her, or anyone for that matter. So there's something going on deep down inside. And so what I started to pray was, God, help me. Fix that thing that I might not even know exists, that thing deep down in the core. Seed it out.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just take off the branches. I need the very seed out. I need the core out. I need this thing gone. And so God is healing, and he's delivering, and he's setting free. And every day I'm learning something new about myself, and I'm just really learning to appreciate the journey. And I feel like sharing my story is very empowering.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, you said something as it relates to the pattern of abuse. You talked about it starting with emotional abuse and then escalating into the physical abuse. And I think that's one of the things that I love about having this conversation is that oftentimes when we have conversations in our professional work with women who talk about being emotionally abused, they don't recognize it as abuse because there are some cultural norms that exist there. And so if we listen to today's music, if we think about a lot of what we see on reality TV, we oftentimes hear women of color being spoken to exactly the way they're talked about in songs or exactly the way they're talked to on television. And then when younger women are coming into relationships, because they've seen all of this, it starts to play out in their relationship, and it seems normal because it is a cultural norm. So talk to us a little bit about how you saw or how you see things evolving in African-American culture with our music, with the media in general.
Yeah, so I think things are actually getting worse with media, with music, with a lot of the reality television. Even if you don't see men necessarily putting their hands on a woman, it's definitely power and control. And those are the two components of domestic violence. It's about power and control. So anytime you have a man that will manipulate you for whatever purpose, that's an abusive relationship, whether he ever puts his hands on you or not. Any man that doesn't build you up, that breaks you down, that's a manipulation. He's breaking you down for his own purpose, for its own reason, whatever that should be. So I'm just thinking the trends that we find in music, that we see on reality TV, the images that we see in dramas, we just really need to be mindful that those images are not realistic. Even reality TV is scripted to a point.
Absolutely.
And so I no longer watch reality TV because I found that the way that it portrayed the black woman was also portraying an image that maybe she even deserved to be treated that way, and no one deserves to be abused in any way, shape, or form. And so I'm really against reality TV and all those images that come out in the media because I think it does a disservice to our community.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I'm with you. I have a 17-year-old daughter as well, and I don't allow her to watch music videos. There's some music that I don't allow her to listen to. And there are some images that I try very hard to keep her away from. Unfortunately, there are some things. She goes to school. She doesn't live in a bubble. So there are some things that she will see and hear. But it's very important to me that she understand that those images have nothing to do with the reality of life as I hope that she'll know it as a young woman and someday as a girlfriend and someday hopefully as a wife if that's her choice. So I hear you. I want to talk a little bit about your journey into ministry. How that happened, how that evolved, and maybe you could share some things with us about that.
Right. So how I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness, so this is a really unique story, and I just felt like I was searching for something. And I started to attend local churches in the Boston area, and I got to one church, and I actually really liked it, and I stayed there, and I got involved with service. I was actually in a different relationship at this point, and I joined this church. I got saved there. And then I got pregnant. And so the shame and embarrassment of being pregnant, unmarried, at this good Baptist church kind of ran me off. And no one there made me feel bad. I felt bad within myself. So I stopped attending church regularly, and then I had my daughter. And then I went to a different church where no one knew me. I just showed up with this baby. They weren't aware of whatever was going on. And so I started to go there, and I started to get involved in ministry. I started off on the usher ministry, and just as I started to go to church more regularly, God was really dealing with me. And so I experienced something that I had never before, and that was the presence of God and the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. And the first time I experienced that, I knew that this is where I needed to be. This is what I was born for, mm-hmm. to be a part of something like this. And so I really took my relationship with Christ very seriously. So eventually I was appointed to usher ministry leader. I kind of worked myself up through the ranks, and then I was ordained, or licensed rather, as a minister this past June. And I think that journey has been one that's been about 14 years in the making. So I didn't just arrive. I've been attending my current church for 14 years now. And so I've done the work. I've showed myself faithful. I've been diligent in ministry. I've served in every capacity I could. And so I just think it was time. I always believed there was a calling on my life. And I believe that God chose me for a special assignment, and so I wanted to be obedient to him.
And so I actually am getting a message here that says that if anyone is interested in calling in and asking questions, they can call us at 347-327-9611. They can hit the number 1 on the key. Actually, I guess we do have listeners who are on the line, and so if they'd like to ask a question, they can hit the number 1 on their keypad, and they can ask the question. Again, that is hitting the number 1 on their keypad. So I also want to just take a moment and introduce myself again for those that may be joining us a little late and reintroduce my guest. My name is Reverend Tracy Jackson Antoine, calling from Boston, Massachusetts. I am the director of the Domestic and Sexual Violence Project for the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts. The Urban League's Domestic and Sexual Violence Project is actually just 3 years old. We are excited about this work and excited about the role that we've been able to play in the community, and I'm happy to share more about the project and what we do here in Boston. But my special guest for tonight is Minister Tasha Bradshaw. She is a native of Bostonian as well, and I'm going to ask her just really briefly to remind those of us who have been listening and share with those who are just joining us what her role is in the community.
So I do social work. I work with families that have children with severe emotional disturbances, and I'm passionate about this work because a lot of the moms that I encounter suffer from domestic violence. I'm also a minister at my local church, and I am a mom of 2. I am in school pursuing my master's degree in business, and I'm just really excited to be here to talk about this very important issue, an issue that oftentimes plagues the African-American community.
So, again, you can press the number 1 on your keypad, and the producer will take your question, and we will be happy to answer any questions that you have. It's the number 1 on your keypad, and I'm watching very diligently for him to let me know that there is a caller with a question. So we were talking about Tasha's journey to ministry, and so tell me about how it is, if at all, domestic violence is part of your ministry, since that is your personal story. Is it part of the ministry that you're doing at your church? What kind of domestic violence programming does your church offer? What have you done?
So we don't necessarily have a domestic violence program at my church, but what I do notice is that a lot of women that are struggling with domestic violence issues, they seek me out. So I feel like that I can really identify someone that's been abused or is being abused. And a lot of times those women will seek me out for prayer, for counseling, or just support. We don't necessarily have enough women involved right now who are suffering from it to actually have a full-fledged ministry, but we definitely do support women who are suffering with domestic violence issues.
Would you tell the audience a little bit about the programming that that we did at your church. Actually, it was done in two parts.
So Reverend Tracy actually did a workshop at my church, just really identifying what signs domestic violence has. A lot of it talked about power and control and manipulation and abuse, and something simple as ignoring your partner or you're not speaking to your partner or taking your partner's paycheck. Those are all acts of domestic violence. So even if a man doesn't put his hands on you, because I think that's obvious, right? If he smacks you or punches you or hits you or kicks you, everyone says that that's DV. But there's emotional and mental DV. There's DV that manifests itself in a financial way, men that make women work and take their checks, or men that make women have more babies so that they can receive a check from the system, or men who don't allow women to see their families. And so those kind of things happen, men who don't allow women to attend church or men who manipulate women away from their relationship. There are certain religions that really believe that men have a certain level of power and control over their wives. And so in those instances, wives are sometimes subject to the husband's abuse. And so at my church, we don't teach that. We teach that the husband should love the wife as Christ loved the church. And if you're a Bible reader, you'll understand that Christ loved the church so much that he sacrificed and he died for the church. So that's the kind of love that us women should be looking for from a man. You want a relationship with a man that will love and that will sacrifice for you. The Bible says where your heart is, there will your treasure be also. So you want to find a man that treasures you, because love gives and it treasures you and it treats you like a treasure.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I believe we have a question. We have a LaDonna Combs calling from Detroit who has a question for us.
Good evening. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. This is Reverend LaDonna Combs from Detroit, Michigan, and I just want to say how much I am enjoying the show and enjoying your story and how you're telling the things that you've gone through and what you're doing. And I guess my comment is that we in Detroit also am the director of a domestic violence faith-based program. And I was hearing you as I was listening to the show say that you work with mothers in the community of special needs children who have an intersection also of domestic violence or self-disclose some domestic violence in their homes as well. And I was wondering how responsive they are to you as being a survivor, or do they also respond to you as being a faith leader wanting to help them with those challenges?
Yep, and I think I share as I need to, right? So I don't come out the gate with I'm a survivor of DV, because the program I work for is not necessarily a DV program. The program that I work for services children. However, what I'm finding is 80% of the moms that I work with have suffered from DV. And so I share as necessary. If families want me to pray, if families want help finding churches in the community, I will do all of that. What I love about my job is it's kind of like a pitfall for everything that, air quotes, professionals can't do, because I'm not bound by some of the restrictions that some other social workers are. My role is very unique in the sense that I get to be a little bit unconventional with the way I service these families. And so that's what I appreciate about my position.
Oh, that's excellent. Mm-hmm. That is good. That's good. Okay, and so in your church, I was listening at you saying that you have a leader, a pastor, that, you know, that patriarchal interpretation of the Bible that's really oppressive to faith-based women, and it really doesn't lend to an environment for them to self-disclose. And I think you were saying that your pastor doesn't teach that kind of interpretation for women being the lesser citizen in the marriage. And I was thinking, do you have a domestic violence program that you actually lead in the church as well, or do you have a support group in your church as well?
We don't have a domestic violence ministry at this time because we just don't have the need for it. But we do support women who are we do support women who are actually dealing with domestic violence issues, and we have Reverend Tracy come in and do workshops and do teachings, and we really divert to her for her expertise anytime we have an issue that is out of our realm. She's been to our church a few times to do workshops and to do teachings with the men and the women on DD.
I think that, and that's excellent, because you do need, a community collaborator, an expert, and the church needs to have that resource. And I know Reverend Antoine is a wonderful resource nationally, as well as there in the Boston area. I think you couldn't have a greater partner than her working with that. I think that makes your church actually even more comprehensive to be able to collaborate with someone like her. When you have those issues of, you know, being well-informed is so important in the faith community, because historically it's not something the church deals with. It's more of an evolving response to domestic violence. So I think that's awesome that you guys are doing that.
Well, one of the things I appreciate about my bishop is that we know that man is a tri-human being. He's mind, soul, and spirit. He's body, soul, and spirit. Your body is your physical man. Your soul is where your emotions are, and your spirit is how you connect to man. So we believe in service in each one of those parts of the tri-human being. So what we try to do from a natural perspective is we actually have Tracy come in sometimes and preach a DB sermon on a Sunday. We've had her do it. She'll come in on a Sunday morning, and she'll just preach about DB. She'll do teaching. She brings resources. She brings her team. It really does a comprehensive job at helping us understand that DV is not just physical, but it could be mental, it could be emotional, it could be spiritual. It can come across in different ways. And Tracy does a really good job, Reverend Tracy, does a really good job of exposing the hidden DV that sometimes we don't even know that we're prey to.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And I can attest to that. I know you have a phenomenal partner for violence prevention with Reverend Antoine. We know that to be a fact.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling in. You have a great day.
You too. Thank you. Thank you, Reverend Antoine, for taking my call.
Sure. Thank you for calling in, Reverend Combs. So it's wonderful that we've actually had an opportunity to dig a little deeper with Reverend Combs and talk more about training and the importance of having training in faith-based communities. Talk to us a little bit about the intersection of DV and the challenges that some of these moms are going through, because one of the things that concerns me greatly is that oftentimes as people of color, we don't get to the resources. So you said you're going and doing home visits. Talk to us a little bit about what that looks like.
Yeah, so when I do a home visit, I typically go in and I check in with mom and see how things are going. And I think initially they're not open to talking about their personal life. So I have to find buy-in. I have to find a way to engage with moms. I've had moms that I knew something was going on, but I wasn't really sure. So on those occasions, I try to get mom out the house where the abuser is not present. And then I share my story as needed just to get her to understand that I'm invested in her. And then moms tend to share. And I tell them, I'm not going to share this information. Like, I think anonymity is important.
Absolutely.
To moms. And just keeping their business secret and private is important to them. I think a lot of times what I'm seeing in the community is that moms sometimes stay with the abuser because he's the financial provider, or because they don't have anywhere else to go, or sometimes they're just afraid to leave. And so because I understand what that process is, I connect them with different organizations that can help them. Urban League has been huge in that, helping to direct me to resources. And I've used different shelters and stuff to kind of get moms out. But I think what people have to understand is a mom that doesn't leave is not stupid.
Yeah.
A mom that doesn't leave is not weak. It takes an incredible amount of courage to live in the house with someone who's unpredictable, who could hit you at any moment, who could do whatever he wants to do to you, and you're subject to him. That takes an incredible amount of courage. So a woman who chooses to stay until it's the right time to leave is not weak. She's not stupid. And I think society paints that picture of women who stay in DV situations. Women stay for many different reasons. And I think as a community, we have to do a better job of understanding victims who stay.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes your very life depends on it. There are some statistics that say the first 3 months after leaving is the most detrimental. Women who get killed by their abusers happens within the first 3 months. So a lot of times women are taking their time to plan this thing out carefully, particularly if there are children involved.
Absolutely.
If the parent, the dad has partial custody, a mom can't just take the kid and leave, even if he is being abusive. There are laws to protect everybody. And unfortunately, sometimes women slip through the cracks and can't get the help that they need because of laws that are connected to their children.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you shared that because I think if I were to think through some of the conversations that I've had with spiritual leaders, and not just in Boston but across the country, I think the question that I'm asked more than any other question is, why don't women just leave? And so I'm really thrilled that you brought that up because I think it's interesting that we oftentimes will ask the question, why doesn't she just leave, but we seldom ask the question, why does he abuse?
Absolutely.
And so I'm glad that you brought that up, and you're absolutely right. There are lots of reasons oftentimes that women are not able to leave or do not choose to leave, you know, finances being one of one of the reasons I think I hear the most is that I can't afford to leave. I can't afford to live on my own, or I don't have a means of income. He is the sole means of income. You know, you're talking about taking your children out of school conceivably and moving them to a new school or a new location. If you have to go into shelter, what does that look like? Many shelters will not take male children. How do you handle that if you have a son? And bringing your family into a shelter situation that uproots your entire life. And so what does that look like? It is not as simple as people like to think that it is, that you can just up and walk away. And so I think that it's important that you talk about that and that you share that and that you share the fact that many women take all the courage they have to stay in that situation and plan it carefully and think about what will it look like if I leave and how do I do that and when do I do that, when is the right time, because I talk to women every single day in my office who want to very much to leave but don't have the resources and can't necessarily think about how their children will fare if they take their children away from their fathers. Oftentimes, abusers are really good fathers. Abusers are really good mothers. And then, you know, the other part of it is, and I hear this all the time, people don't want their relationships to end. They want the abuse to stop. They have seen this person in better days. There was something that caused them to fall in love or fall in like, whatever that looks like for this person, and all they're trying to do is to get back to that moment again. And if you're talking about the cycle of abuse being, you know, sort of those honeymoon periods, and then, you know, the tension builds up, and then there is, you know, a catastrophe, and then we start the cycle all over again, women are oftentimes in the midst of that cycle trying to get back to the good days.
Absolutely.
Waiting patiently for them to come back because they know they do.
Absolutely.
They've come back in the past.
Let me tell you about my abuser, just something very shortly. My abuser, when we moved in together, paid all the bills. He bought me the best gift ever. My check was my check to keep. He paid for everything in the house. He would literally come in, sit his paycheck on the dresser, and say, take care of the bills every single week. Every single week. So when you're a woman, right, and maybe you, I didn't have kids then, but if you have a couple of kids and you've been struggling, it's easy to get caught up in that, right? Because abusers can oftentimes be very good providers. They romance you. No one takes you out on the first date and smacks you, right? No one does that because you wouldn't have a second date. Abusers do a good job of priming you. I call it priming you. They take you out, they romance you, you get flowers at work, you know, you got champagne dinners, you're going to the high-end restaurant, he's treating you like a queen, he's buying you this. My first designer bag was from my abuser, right? So they treat you really, really good, and then you fall in love because he seems to be this awesome guy. and then you realize that there's a dark side, and a lot of times it's shaped in jealousy. My abuser was very jealous. Every time we got into a fight, it was about me and some other person that I looked at, or that they saw me somewhere. It was always some story made up, but it was always wrapped in jealousy. One of the things our society does a really good job of, and I'm glad you brought it up, saying, like, why doesn't she leave? We're good at victim blaming. And like you said, we never ask, why does he abuse? We always ask, why doesn't she leave? And we got to ask the right questions. That's just like accusing someone who got robbed, why did she have that expensive purse? It would have never got snatched. Why did she have this short dress on? She would have never been raped. And so we do a good job of blaming the victim, and we have to get back to holding people who are abusers accountable. And I'm not saying that abusers should be counted out. They need help, too.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that I think we talk about a lot in the work that we do in the African-American community is how do we save our families? We cannot afford to throw our men away.
Absolutely.
And I often hear women say that their fear is that, especially if their abuser is the father of their children, their fear is that they are going to destroy their families. And that they grew up in a home where they did not have a father, it is not their desire to see their children grow up in a home without their father. And so I think that's something we have to take very seriously, and I think it is a perfect place for the church to step in and play a part in not only holding abusers accountable, but providing the counseling and the support that men need to get the help and services they need so that they can remain a part of their family, even if the relationship isn't salvageable. And oftentimes they are not. But when they are, we want the church to be positioned to help support that. And when they are not, we want the church to be positioned to help individuals mourn the loss of the relationship and move on with their lives. And I think that in the African-American community in particular, that is the place that we have to find ourselves. That we are working harder at healing families, and that we are working harder at prevention and starting earlier in the prevention process with our boys and girls, even as early as Christian Learning School, talking about things like bullying, talking about things like respect and honor and what that looks like. Because one of the other challenges that I find in my professional work, and I'm sure you do as well, Minister Bradshaw, is that we are oftentimes finding ourselves asking our African-American men to mirror behavior they've never seen before. And so if I didn't grow up with a father in the house, if I did not have positive male role models in my life, how then am I to be what I've never seen? And so people get married, and we ask them a lot of questions about their physical health, even if you're filling out paperwork for a marriage certificate, but nobody asks you whether or not you've ever seen a husband, and certainly we don't ask whether or not you've ever seen a good one. And so how do we help people? But again, I feel as if the church can do that. You know, if we're marrying people as spiritual leaders, you and I, we should be doing premarital counseling with those couples before those weddings take place, and we should be meeting with them together, but we should also be meeting with them separately. You know, if I'm meeting with a couple and I'm doing that separate meeting, I'm talking to them about the five love languages and how each of them loves and whether or not they have that understanding of one another. I'm talking to them about having seen each other in all four seasons, because everybody's wonderful in spring and summer, but what happens in winter and fall can be a different story. Have you seen this person angry? What does that look like? Have you ever felt afraid of them? Have you had an argument? What did that look like? And so I think that those are the important conversations that we as faith leaders can have. And again, we're talking specifically about Black church. You know, we can broaden the spectrum and talk about a whole lot of different things, but if we're talking about African-American culture and as spiritual leaders, these are absolutely conversations we should be having with people before we even perform weddings. And we should be willing to say, if in fact we have concerns, that we're not willing perform a wedding. And, you know, I've done that. I've had to do that. And in one particular instance where I did it, the couple had a huge issue about 2 months after I said I would not perform the wedding, where she actually stabbed him, and he ended up in the emergency room, and she ended up in jail. And so I think we have to be willing to say I won't do it, you know.
And I think it's important that we're clear that, I'm glad you said that, because DV is not just men to women. That's just my story because I'm a woman and my abuser was a man. But there are women who abuse men as well, and it goes back and forth sometimes. And unfortunately, a lot of men are afraid to come forward and say that they've been abused because of the same reasons women don't, shame, pride, and all that stuff. But I also wanted to mention another thing. You talked about seeing a person in all four seasons. I also want to challenge people to be mindful of a man or a woman who never gets angry. People get angry sometimes, right? So if I've been with you for 2 years and you never get angry, nothing ever upsets you, something's not really right about that. And so just being mindful that people have all kinds of emotions. How does he manage his anger? He should get angry sometimes. Everyone gets upset sometimes. So just being mindful of that.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we only have 5 minutes left, and I knew this hour was going to go by really quickly, and it would have been wonderful if we could have done this for 2 hours, but I have a feeling if that were the case, we'd have been saying the same thing. Oh, 2 hours is not enough time because there's so much to say and there's so much good information we can share, and not just as a victim or a survivor of domestic violence yourself, but as a community leader, as a woman of God, as a mother, as a mentor to some. I feel like what you bring to our community is invaluable. And so I thank you for your hard work. I thank you for your commitment to changing the lives of others. I thank you for your transparency in sharing your story. It's so important that we hear the story from someone who has really gone through it. You know, the scriptures say that, you know, that we are overcome by the words of our testimony. So your testimony is just that. It is your story, but it's meant to be shared with others. It wasn't ever really about you from a spiritual perspective. It was about those that you would minister to later in life. And so I thank you so much for your willingness to share it. So many would not, because there is that whole sense of who we are that we like people to see us in a certain vein. And so I appreciate the fact that you're so honest and that you're willing to share your time with us on tonight. In closing, I just want you to share with us, if you would, just something you would say to someone who is a victim, even in this moment, who might be listening, who, you know, maybe didn't want to ask the question because they didn't want to be heard, whatever that looks like. But if you could say anything to them at all, tell them something that you believe will make a difference for them.
One of the things I want to say is just prayer. Mm-hmm. And today's the National Day of Prayer, right? So great way to start grounding yourself. It's just finding a relationship with God and just praying and talking to him. There are no special words, no eloquent words. It's just crying out to God and asking God to help and lead you and guide you. The other thing is I would say community and family connections are so important. Having natural supports in place to help you, to process with you, because there's a reason why abusers take you away from your family and create that distance. They alienate you on purpose because once you're alone, they can do more damage that way. But if you're surrounded by a village of people who love you and don't allow yourself to be alienated, it's harder for that person to get in. So I would say maintain or recreate community connections, particularly family and loved ones. And I would say go to a local shelter if you're currently in a DV situation and just talk to someone about starting the process, thinking about getting out. You don't have to leave tonight, but you want to start thinking about what's available in case you have to leave.
Thank you so much. I agree. You know, there are so many. One of the things that we say when we talk about a coordinated community response, we talk about having relationships in place before you need them.
Absolutely.
And I want to say how courageous so many women are that talk to you, that talk to me. Sharing your story with someone you don't know takes a lot of courage. Sometimes just hearing yourself say, "This is where I am," can help start that process, as you described, of trying to figure out what next steps look like. I love doing this work. I know that you love doing it, too. And I love that we were able to share a little bit about our work and that you were able to share a lot about your personal story with us on tonight. We want to say thank you to everyone who listened in, and thank you to Pastor J.R. Sicklin and Dr. Oliver Williams. Good night.
Good night.
Well, that's it for today's show. You've been listening to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio, right here every week at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio is brought to you by the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, in collaboration with the Women of Color Network and the African American Domestic Peace Project. Visit us on the web at idvac.org to find out more information about our guests and presenters and to download podcasts of previous shows of IDVAC Blog Talk Radio. Until next week, be safe.